Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is Marianne Sieghart. By now, we're all aware of the pay gap between genders, but what about the gaps that are harder to quantify? Marianne's new book, The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It, examines this disparity between the genders, one that can take different shapes but clearly permeates the lives of many women. A prolific journalist and broadcaster, Marianne researched this book whilst a visiting fellow at Oxford University. Marianne, thanks so much for joining me to talk about this really, really important work. What was it for you that made you realise this was such an issue in the world?
Well, I suppose like pretty much every other woman in the world, I've experienced this from time to time all through the course of my life. And it's always sort of been there in the background. It was hard to put a finger on. It always is hard to put a finger on because it's an accumulation of small acts of behaviour that happen to you through your life. So, you know, you make a point at a meeting and no one really takes any notice. And 10 minutes later, a man makes exactly the same point and is lauded for it. Or you're trying to engage in a conversation with men and they just seem so much more interested in what each other has to say than in what you've got to say. Or you find yourself being underestimated and you have to prove your competence before somebody perks up and thinks, oh, maybe she has got something interesting to say. But it was hard sort of really to put a finger on the phenomenon, but it had been something that had been bugging me for a long time. And eventually I thought, there's really something material here that I need to go and research. And really to prove that this isn't something personal to any individual woman, it is really a systemic problem with all our brains. Because the trouble is that each time something like this happens to a woman, she's likely to think, oh, well, maybe I was just being boring, or maybe the point I made wasn't very interesting or very helpful. And it's only once you recognise the pattern that you realise it's not actually your fault. It's the fault of, well, I'm sure we'll be talking about this, but, you know, it's the fault of all the annoying, incorrect stereotypes that lurk somewhere in the recesses of our brains.
And we end up doing it to ourselves as well. I mean, I remember very clearly developing some kind of mild stutter to make myself seem less authoritative and fluent because it was really annoying men.
Well, do you know, this is one of the most depressing things I discovered, which is we generally think that the more competent and authoritative we sound, the more seriously people will take us. And that's certainly true if we're talking to women. But the most depressing thing I found is that talking to men, that actually hinders you sometimes, that they're more likely to be influenced by you if you sound tentative and a little bit apologetic, or yes, maybe have a little bit of a stutter. But that's exactly the opposite of what we're always told to do. We're told not to apologise for our presence, to sound confident, to sound as if we know what we're talking about.
So how do you actually quantify the authority gap? I mean, we can measure how much less women are paid, but is there a way of measuring how this works?
Well, if you look at all the different manifestations of behaviour that it produces, you can do it individually. So, for instance, there was one study which really struck me. A mixed group of people were asked to come to a decision about a child custody case. So this is a subject that you would think women would be just as expert on as men. They weren't being asked to talk about fluid mechanics, for instance. And the group were given all sorts of pieces of information about this family. Some members of the group individually were given specific pieces of information that the other members of the group didn't have. When a man introduced one of these pieces of information into the group discussions, it was six times more likely to be used in the final deliberations than when a woman did. So exactly the same piece of information, people accepted it from a man, but were six times less likely to accept it from a woman. So that's one study, for instance, of influence. Another one, for instance, is of interruptions. And I find this fascinating because it proves that however authoritative you are in the first place as a woman, you still suffer this problem. So 10,000 hours, I think, of transcripts of US Supreme Court hearings were studied. And they found that even though women make up only a third of the Supreme Court justices, they suffer two thirds of all interruptions. So in other words, they were four times more likely to be interrupted than their male colleagues, 96% of the time by men.
And the book has many, many instances like this. I mean, you've really drilled down and done your research and spoken to so many women in authority who still suffer it, and we'll get onto that. But one thing that really struck me was in your second chapter, you look at what we can learn from men and women who've lived as both. I found this absolutely fascinating. Can you tell us more about that?
Yes, I found this the most fascinating chapter of all, actually, because I thought it's so hard for any individual woman to prove that she was disadvantaged because of someone else's bias. So suppose her male colleague who was at the same level as her gets promoted and she doesn't, people can just say, well, it's because he's better than you. There is one really scientific way of measuring this, and that is to look at people who've experienced life in both genders. And what I found is that trans men, that is, people who were born as a woman and transitioned to living as a man, found that they were taken dramatically more seriously once they were seen by other people as a man. So people stopped and listened when they opened their mouths. Their work, the same damn work, as one professor put it, was taken more seriously. They ended up, on the whole, being paid more. So there was one particular example of a Stanford professor called Ben Barres, who transitioned to living as a man in middle age. And he said, I've had the thought a million times, I'm just taken more seriously now. And someone was overheard who didn't know his history at the back of one of his seminars saying, oh, Ben Barres gave such a great seminar today, but then his work's so much better than his sister's. The very same person. And so the reason it's scientific is that these are exactly the same people with the same ability, intelligence, personality, experience, body of work, and the only thing that has changed is their gender. So you are isolating the very variable that matters. And of course, trans women find exactly the opposite, that suddenly people start interrupting them, talking over them, not really listening to them attentively. And they notice how striking the difference is too.
Yeah, absolutely. And this whole thing about interruption, I mean, you've got a wonderfully named chapter. If you could just let me finish.
Exactly.
And that absolutely does prove that women are interrupted all of the time, most of the time.
They are. They're interrupted a lot more than men are, and mainly by men. And this is a pattern that starts very early in childhood. So even very young boys will interrupt girls much more than girls interrupt them. Parents will interrupt their daughters more than they interrupt their sons. And you see all the way through school how boys are taught that they're somehow entitled to more speaking time than girls. So in lessons, lots of classroom observations have shown that boys are more likely to be asked questions. If they shout out an answer without raising their hand, the teacher will accept it. If a girl does it, the teacher's more likely to say, raise your hand if you want to speak. Boys are more often called to the front of the class. They're just given more teacher attention. And girls are taught to be studious and quiet and well-behaved. And you then see this continue into adulthood. And the problem is that women are often penalised at work because they're told, well, you don't speak up enough at meetings, you're not assertive enough. But the women are actually being very rational. First of all, they've discovered if they do speak up, they're much more likely to be interrupted, talked over, their points ignored, their expertise challenged. So that in itself makes them think, well, why bother? And also, of course, dents their confidence. But also what these studies show is that women who talk supposedly too much are seen as incompetent, whereas men who talk too much are not. And so women know, they can sense in a meeting that there is this sort of backlash once they start talking. And you know, you often hear a woman say, oh goodness, did I talk too much? Very rarely hear a man say that. And the other thing is our perceptions of speaking time. So if a woman has spoken for just 30% of the time, we perceive her to have dominated the conversation.
And you make the point that confidence is not the same as competence.
Absolutely not. And this is part of the problem with the authority gap, I think, which is that men on average come over as more confident than women do, and we tend to take them at their word. And so if they assert something confidently, they may be talking absolute bullshit, but we tend to believe it. And the trouble is that, again, we've got this double bind, because you might say to women, well, you should just be more confident and assertive. You should just lean in more and people will take what you say more seriously. The trouble is, it's not that simple, if only it were, because what happens is if women aren't confident enough, then they're disrespected. But if they are confident enough, they're often disliked. Mm. And the reason is that we have these sneaky little stereotypes hiding in the inner recesses of our brains that tell us that women ought to be warm and nurturing and gentle and unthreatening and uncompetitive and unassertive, whereas men should be confident and assertive and in charge and showing leadership. Now, if a woman wants to be taken seriously, she has to show those so-called male characteristics, doesn't she? She has to be competent and confident and assertive. And that makes people feel uncomfortable. And it makes women feel uncomfortable too sometimes. And you see this in the adjectives that are often used of women who are confident and assertive, and they're described as things like abrasive or strident or aggressive or stern or ball-breaking or bitchy even. We don't like it when women behave like that. And yet, if they want to be taken seriously, they have to behave like that. So there is this incredibly fine line that women have to tread between being not confident enough and being seen by other people as too confident. And the only way they can really achieve that is by ladling on oodles of warmth. So smiling a lot and making jokes and being terribly careful not to threaten men's egos, all this sort of thing, which is an enormous burden that men simply don't have to bear.
And we do it to each other too. I mean, I think some women are guilty of this too, and women in power particularly provoke anger from other women.
They do sometimes, yes. I mean, slightly more from other men than from other women. So if you look at Hillary Clinton, for instance, she did win more votes than Donald Trump, but she didn't win the Electoral College. And the main reason was that too many men who had voted for Obama weren't prepared to vote for her. Actually, just as many women carried on voting for her, but she lost those men. But yes, there are women who have a bias against women in power. And it's because we've all been brought up with the same stereotypes in our brains that associate male with authority. We've just been brought up in a world in which probably our father earned more than our mother. Maybe our father worked outside the home more than our mother did. And in a world in which men have mainly been in charge. And it takes a lot to change those stereotypes.
Now, you did around 50 interviews with women in positions of authority and gave us lots of wonderful examples. I'd like to start with an example from your own life, though, because you were snubbed hugely publicly by Andrew Neil on the Daily Politics.
I was, yes. I was invited onto the Daily Politics on a Friday, which was the day in which they would get two pundits to talk about every item in the programme. So to stay on air for the whole time, for the whole hour, and talk about six different topics. And I was invited on with my good friend and colleague from The Times, Daniel Finkelstein. And Danny and I have had a very equal relationship over the years, talking about politics together and treat each other as complete equals. So we both appeared on the show. And on the first question, Andrew went to Danny first and then to me and then back to Danny for a follow-up and not to me. And the pattern continued. I wasn't quite so aware of it at the time, but I just thought at the end, gosh, I really didn't get a very fair look in there. So I watched it back and Andrew went to Danny six times out of six and then sometimes back to him again for a second bite at the cherry and never back to me. And I thought, you know, you would expect 3-3, 4-2 I would have forgiven, 5-1 I would have raised my eyebrows, but 6-0, I mean, that could not have been more disrespectful, really, if he'd tried.
So what about some of the other women you spoke to? I mean, one woman that really impressed us all with her huge takedown in Parliament was Julia Gillard of Australia.
Yes, Julia Gillard is fascinating on this. And in fact, she's written a brilliant book called Women and Leadership. So she has actually studied this phenomenon too. She said that even when she was Prime Minister, she was quite often treated by, say, captains of industry or men high up in the security services in a sort of avuncular, condescending way. She said rather like that of kind uncle to favourite niece. And she said, you know, they were trying to be benign, but actually it wasn't really appropriate to treat the Prime Minister like that. Of course, she got much worse from the leader of the opposition, you know, and he would stand in front of placards saying things like ditch the witch. I mean, she really had the most horrible misogynistic time as Prime Minister. She was Australia's first and so far only Prime Minister, female Prime Minister, sorry.
What about Bernardine Evaristo, the author?
Yes, I mean, Bernardine was fascinating on so many subjects. And of course, I should emphasise that all these problems are doubly or trebly worse if you are a woman of colour as well as being female. or indeed if you're disabled or working class. This isn't a book just about white corporate feminism. Yes, I mean, Bernardine told me stories such as she is, as well as being a fabulous Booker Prize winning novelist, she is also a professor of creative writing. She once took one of her students out for lunch to do their tutorial over lunch, young white girl with a black woman in her 50s. And the waitress addressed all her dealings to the young white girl, you know, asked her, offered her the bill, asked her for the order. Bernardine was open-mouthed. And she said, you know, she will quite often give a seminar and she can see these middle-aged white men sitting in the front row, arms folded, radiating, what on earth has this woman got to teach me?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, as you point out, it's not just about white women. You have a wonderful chapter on the intersection of prejudice. Can you just untangle that for us?
Yes. Well, all the problems that white women have are multiplied hugely if they come from a different background. So if they are a woman of colour, or if they're working class, or if they're disabled. Interestingly, sexuality has a slightly more complex relationship. So some lesbians find they're actually taken a bit more seriously than straight women. And that may be because the stereotypes don't apply quite so strongly to them. So they're expected to behave in a slightly more masculine way. And that actually helps them. So for instance, after having children, straight women suffer hugely in career terms, even if they don't want to step back, as it were, from their career a bit to spend more time with their children. Even if they're just as ambitious and committed, they are still marked down at work and find it very hard to get promoted and to get pay rises. Lesbian women, after having babies, don't suffer this motherhood penalty, which I found interesting. But, you know, the hardest thing is all the racial stereotypes being compounded on the female stereotypes, the gender stereotypes. So, you know, Asian women expected to be submissive, black women expected to be angry. I mean, if only we could get rid of these stereotypes and just treat the person in front of us as an individual person, life would just be so much easier.
What about someone like Margaret Thatcher, who almost sort of in some ways was seen as one of the boys?
Yes, and deliberately acted as one of the boys, and probably quite sensibly for the time in which she lived, because in those days it was so exceptional to have a woman in charge. And the one thing she was terrified of was that she would be seen as weak, because women were seen as weaker than men. And the last thing you want as a leader of your country is somebody who is weak. And so she perhaps overemphasized all her so-called masculine characteristics of strength and reveled in being called the Iron Lady. In private, actually, she could be quite flirtatious with some of the more good-looking members of her cabinet and was also very solicitous of her staff in a traditionally female way. But the image she wanted to project was to be more masculine than the men. And she was also, I think in her generation, this was much more common, she was a real queen bee. So she only promoted one woman to her cabinet in her, 13 years in office, and that for only a very brief time. I think she rather reveled in being the only woman. The other thing Margaret Thatcher did was deliberately to lower her voice really dramatically. So she had a lot of voice training because before she did so, she was described as shrill. Shrill is a word that is never applied, obviously, to men, and it is always derogatory when applied to women. But to get your voice heard over the tumult in Parliament, sometimes women's voices have to rise. So she was taught how to keep hers low. And she lowered the pitch of her voice by about half the difference between the average female and the average male voice. Not everybody liked it. Keith Waterhouse famously said, "I cannot bring myself to vote for a woman who sounds as if she's telling me that my dog has just died."
But I mean, it's so true. I've deliberately lowered my voice too. I mean, it is something that we do. We do what we can to cope. And what this book does brilliantly is it not only points out this huge gap, but it starts to give us places from which we can build an alternative future. So how can we change this?
Well, there are so many things we can do. I've actually got 140 recommendations at the back of the book for things that we can do as individuals, as partners, as parents, as colleagues, as employers, as society. Because, as I said earlier, it is an accumulation of small acts that disadvantage us as women. And so it is an accumulation of small solutions that will eventually help to narrow the authority gap. But the most important thing that we all have to do is to acknowledge that we have this unconscious bias against women. However intelligent or humane or liberal or indeed female we are, we all have it. So I have a bias against women and I've written a whole book about it. I will occasionally hear perhaps a young woman with quite a high voice on the radio being interviewed, and she sounds perhaps a bit childish in the way that men can't because their voices break. And I'll find myself thinking, oh, I wonder if she knows what she's talking about. But I will immediately stop and say, now, stop it. That is your sneaky little bias talking. Listen to the content of what she's saying and then judge her. So we all have to do this in every facet of our lives, really. Notice if we're not listening as attentively to women as to men. Notice if when we walk up to a man and a woman standing together, we automatically address the man first. Notice if we underestimate a woman's intelligence or competence and are then surprised when it turns out she's actually brilliant. All these things we can do, but we just have to get into the habit of it. And it's hard, you know, it's like learning not to bite your nails or not to slump at your desk. But the more you do it, the easier it becomes.
And how can we all gain then from narrowing that authority gap?
Well, what I found most cheering, I think, in researching this book is that obviously women will gain from narrowing the authority gap, but so will men. And this sounds really counterintuitive. You would think that gender equality is like a seesaw in which as women rise, men fall. But this actually isn't the case. So it may be in one individual instance, if you're a man and you're going for a job up against a woman who beats you to it, that you think, oh, I don't like this gender equality business if she has been fairly assessed for once. But actually, more broadly, in more gender equal societies and in more gender equal relationships, you find that not only are women healthier and happier and children healthier and happier and do better at school and are better behaved, but so are the men. And so men in more gender equal countries and relationships are twice as likely to say they're satisfied with their lives, half as likely to be depressed, less likely to drink, to smoke, to take drugs, to be violent. Their relationships tend to last longer. They sleep better at night. And here is the absolute clincher, they get more frequent and better sex. So what's not to like?
Marianne, one of the great problems, though, as people throughout the ages have found, women authors throughout the ages have found, is that you're less likely to be read by men if you come out, if you like, as a woman on the cover of your book. I mean, you've got many examples of that in this work. So will men read you?
Oh, I so hope that men read me. And I wrote the whole book with men as well as women in mind. And we had long deliberations about the cover. I kept saying, I want this to be a cover that a man won't feel embarrassed to be seen reading on the tube. I don't want any pink. I don't want any curly writing. I want this to be a unisex book. And I made sure that there were two endorsements from men on the cover as well as two from women. And I was thrilled, actually, when the Sunday Times gave it to a man to review. And he said that he warmly recommended it to other men. Because while, of course, I'll be thrilled if women read this book, we're not going to change the world unless men read it too.
And it was a very funny review. He ended by saying, you know, and really, you should believe me because I'm a man. I have the authority.
Exactly.
Marianne, it's a really great book. It's a really necessary book. And I think it's one that both genders should read. Even women who are very much aware of it need to know how we can support others and to be just more conscious of what's going on around us. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure.
That is The Authority Gap, Why Women Are Taken Less Seriously Than Men and What We Can Do About It. It's by Marianne Seacart and it's published by Doubleday. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Chrissa Blackwa and Sophie Monaghan-Combs. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.